Hello, good morning, welcome. I am Samuel Trapp. This is International Flavor. You are listening to Damn Radio, coming to you live from where? The Lake Ozark Real Estate of the Art Studio. You can listen live every day. You can listen live 24/7 every day, 365. I don't even know if we're shut down. Do we shut down ever? I don't think so. We never take a break unless nature makes us. Today's a very nice day. We have lots of rain. It's beautiful out there. It was, I even got some sleep. That could mean, excuse me, got a little bit froggy there. Got a froggy in my throat, but it's a, I got some sleep last night. That might make me a bit on the wild side. That's a wild thing, but not wild side. If we take a walk on the wild side, I got some music to discuss today. I wanted to get a theme going on the show. And I suppose I should explain myself before I get cruising today. Unfortunately, in my humble view, we increasingly live inside a world where it's actually a competition for a description of what reality is. And everybody, now, if you choose, you're allowed to create your own reality. That's allowed. You can create disputes that don't exist. You can create intentions that don't exist. You can live in your own tiny little bubble, your own paranoid little bubble, and send out nonsensical things to anyone else. And you're only reaching out to the outside world of your own lunacy is sending out tiny little snippets of I don't know what, your lack of reality out to hit the real world to see how it will play out there. And so we increasingly live inside this competing world where governments, local, state, federal, all over the world, people have their own reality that they get to create. And sometimes it's based on reality. Sometimes it's based on propaganda. Governments don't necessarily have to tell us outright lies. They just have to gloss over, speak in. You've seen people do this. They're amazing. Okay. You can call and have, a 5-minute conversation, and when you're done with it, you go, "No, what did he say?" Like my radio show at the, but I'm supposed to do that. I'm supposed to, minus for entertainment, right? If I'm calling and I have a point that I want to get to with somebody, I'm pretty blunt about it, and it's time to get to the point, and I tell you what it is. I remember when I was in high school, and you take those little tests, and like I don't remember 10th grade, they're trying to send you where you want to go. And mine was, you take the test and it comes back, "I don't have a job." It's at the top of the thing. And it said, "You'd be a good generalist. You'd be a good generalist." I'm like, "What the hell is a generalist?" You know? And the second one, lawyer. And now I had planned on being a lawyer since I was about 10, right? So that was pretty well long before decided, way before I ever took the test. And I just took that as a method to go, well, you know, this is the reality is I'm supposed to be a lawyer because that's you know, what I think about. It's what I've always thought about. It's how I've lived my life, blah, blah, blah. And so, okay, but the second one, the only two I got on my list, there was no, "Oh, gee, you might be a good nuclear scientist." Of course not. You know, I may possibly have seeds of intelligence tucked away somewhere in my brain, and I can know a lot of stuff about a lot of things, but I'm an expert in not very much. You know, I could never fix your car. Jesus, you wouldn't want me to do that. I can barely spell car, let alone I look at them and I become suddenly, I don't know what. But realities are out there. In my reality, I had to pick and choose, and I found out that a generalist, actually, used to talk about it a lot in human resources, going out, and I relate well to people of different I don't have a certain type of people as the only type of people I hang out with. And I remember doing quite a bit of research on this and why I would be pretty good at it. It's because I'm not, when it started out, it said, you don't prejudge, you know, you don't prejudge based on this. You don't prejudge based on that. You try to look at the big picture. And I've been doing that my whole life. So let's see. When you have governments that do that, though, and that's why perhaps I see the bigger picture a little bit more than a government would like you to. And I don't know if that's true or not. You know, all of that, they probably psychoanalyze me if you wish. But government doesn't necessarily have to tell us lies. They just select the facts that they want you to hear. Omit inconvenient ones, rename whatever their failure is. You know, I've been given my favorite one here over and over and over. You can't say, you can't call it just an SVO, a special military operation. It'd be SMO in English, but SVO in Russian. And you can't just call it the SVO or the war or anything like that. You must say, and so therefore, if I'm going to refer to the war in Ukraine, I'm going to refer to it as Putin's unprovoked war of aggression against the law, illegal, and he's the Antichrist. You have to throw all of these things in there before you say war in Ukraine, and then you can ask your question. So that's how they do it. They select facts, they rename failures, they redefine the objectives. I mean, I shared with you a little bit about the five-year anniversary of Afghanistan yesterday, and that's a big deal. The Afghanistan horrific withdrawal. The entire story of 20 years in there was a complete waste of time, and we didn't do anything. We left billions on the table, trillions in our treasure, our lives, and what did you get out of it? Seriously, what did America receive out of that? You know, what did we give to our children with our stupidity? Not very much, right? And if anything, you know, I'm trying to be positive here. So just redefine the objectives, repeat the resulting narrative until the public accepts the description as that reality. There's a kid, the song when I was a kid, and I found it, and we're going to play it later for you. But one of the lines from it is, "They're coming to take me away, ha ha." Because the interesting contrast in all of this morning is India. While Washington describes the world through categories, general things, this is what happens. You talk about your allies. You talk about your adversaries. There's no detail. You know, they don't talk about that. You learn when you talk to a senator, they can't, they answer in these great big broad paintbrush things, right? Never with a small fine-tipped pencil, right? Sanctioned countries are democratic partners. Wonder what that means. And a threat. What is a threat? I mean, do we know? I mean, where's our threat from Iran? We never hear about that. They talk about, oh, it's a nuclear threat, and they try to get people all jazzed up about that. But India, which I'm focusing on because BRICS is coming up soon, they increasingly behave as though those categories are not particularly useful to them. India can have serious debates and disputes with Pakistan, a serious territorial dispute with China. They can buy energy and maintain strategic relationships with Russia while cooperating with Washington and being a participant in the Quad. And simultaneously, they're chairing BRICS this year. It's coming up in a month. And that's not insanity. It may actually be considerably more rational than demanding that the world divide itself into categories: friend, enemy, threat. You know, those things. So now we come to Napoleon the 14th. Do you guys remember this? Maybe you probably don't. It's pretty funny, but I'm going to share it with you, and I'm probably going to play it twice today. So get used to it. Here it comes. This is a guy named Napoleon the 14th, and the song is called "They're Coming to Take Me Away." Ha ha! And I'm going to share it with you.
Remember when you ran away and I got on my knees and begged you not to leave because I go berserk? Well, you left me anyhow, and then the days got worse and worse, and now you see I've gone completely out of my mind. And they're coming to take me away, ha-ha, they're coming to take me away, ho-ho, hee-hee, ha-ha, to the funny farm where life is beautiful all the time, and I'll be happy to see those nice young men in their clean white coats, and they're coming to take me away, ha-ha! You thought it was a joke, and so you laughed. You laughed when I had said that losing you would make me flip my lid. Right? You know you laughed. I heard you laugh. You laughed, you laughed, and laughed, and then you left. But now you know I'm utterly mad. And they're coming to take me away, ha-ha. They're coming to take me away, ho-ho, hee-hee, ha-ha. To the happy home with trees and flowers and chirping birds and basket weavers who sit and smile and twiddle their thumbs and toes, and they're coming to take me away, ha-ha. I cooked your food, I cleaned your house, and this is how you pay me back for all my kind, unselfish, loving deeds. Ha? Well, you just wait, they'll find you yet. And when they do, they'll put you in the ASPCA, you mangy mutt. And they're coming to take me away, ha-ha. They're coming to take me away, ho-ho, hee-hee, ha-ha. To the funny farm where life is beautiful all the time. And I'll be happy to see those nice young men in their clean white coats. And they're coming to take me away, ha-ha. To the happy home with trees and flowers and chirping birds.
Where life is beautiful all the time, and I'll be happy to see those nice young men in their clean white coats, and they're coming to take me away. Ha ha. That is Napoleon the 14th. He's actually a songwriter. I forget. His name was Jerry something. And I can't remember. But I had to go. That was from 1966. So here you go. Welcome to International Flavor, where apparently life is beautiful all the time. But I want to ask a slightly different question today. What happens when society is so accustomed to misrepresentation that misrepresentation no longer bothers us? Not necessarily lies. That's an accusation, you know, I don't want to go that far. I'm talking about something much more sophisticated. We rename things. We omit things. Oh, what didn't? Wasn't there yesterday Trump renamed the Strait of Hormuz to like Strait of Trump or something? Yeah, good luck with that, Gulf of America. Yeah, that's changed, hasn't it? We rename things. We omit things. We go to the funny farm where life is beautiful all the time and I'll be happy. Oh, well, we tell you one side of a war. We describe countries as isolated while their leaders are sitting around conference tables with half the population of the planet listening. We describe sanctions as devastating while the sanctioned countries build alternative trading systems and payment portals. We call something international community when what we really mean are those that suck up to Washington or Brussels. That's the international community. And eventually, you start to wonder, at least I do, whether Napoleon the 14th wasn't writing a novelty record after all. Maybe he was writing about foreign policy. You wonder, don't you, if old Napoleon the 14th, who named himself, you know, as a world leader, was coming to take me away. And we don't know whether he was singing about his dog. I meant to look into that, but because on the album cover, he's dressed up in a French Napoleon-style outfit from the 1800s. And with a dog leash with a no dog in it. So we wonder if he's talking about his dog that left. You left. And when you left, I went to the funny farm. So here's some fresh news, right? Pakistan just celebrated Independence Day on August the 14th. And Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif used the occasion to return directly to a confrontation that they have with India. And the central issue now isn't just Kashmir, it's water, okay? Sharif described water as Pakistan's red line and warned of a direct response if Pakistan's water rights are threatened. This dispute stems from India's decision after April 2025, the Pahalgam attack, to place participation in the 1960 Indus Waters Treaty in abeyance, meaning they're not going to enforce it. So this 1960 water deal, Pakistan rejects India's ability to get out of that contract, that treaty, to do unilaterally anyway. So the Indus Waters Treaty was signed in 1960 with World Bank involvement and established rights to six rivers in the Indus system. This is why Kashmir area is so important, okay? And Pakistan, well, why the dispute in there is so important. So you can't, Pakistan basically says, you can't just announce that a treaty is in abeyance. You know, we're not doing it. Of course, America does it all the time. Russia has done it several times. America did it in all of our nuclear weapons treaties, nuclear treaties with Russia, all of them. And Trump did the last one, I believe, when he said we're no longer paying attention to this one. Start three or something like that. SALT one and two, I remember. INF treaty, all those things. Nuclear threshold test ban treaty no longer applies. All of these things, it's a little bit ridiculous. And they unilaterally did it. And so Russia's going, well, wait a minute, treaties are treaties. And they go, nah, not anymore. You know, we're done. That's what Pakistan is saying right now about India. So Pakistan is pointing to the treaty's dispute resolution machinery because there's each treaty has. So a treaty, when you write as like a contract, any decent lawyer that could write a contract for you says, you know, when you come up with a contract, you don't just say, all right, here's what we're going to do. You're going to get half. I'm going to get half and sign this paper. I get half. You get half. And we move on and we start this business. Okay, well, there's a hell of a lot more in there that you need to figure out what you're going to talk about. That's why these one minute napkin ideas while you're having dinner with a friend turn into such horrible disputes when you're divorcing from that friend years later. It's because you can't agree on the intakes when it comes in. And then as soon as you get the lawyers in, it's all cocked up anyway because they all think like I do. Well, what if this? What if this? What if this? It's all the what ifs. A good lawyer has to address all the what ifs, or later one of the parties will come and sue him for not thinking, well, why didn't you think of this, you moron? And so that's it. Treaty is nothing more or less than a contract between countries, right? And at the end of any good contract, well, not the end, you could put it at the beginning if you want, but it's what to do upon disagreement and what to do to end the relationship. How does the relationship end? If they required this when people got married, if in order to get a marriage you had to agree in advance while you loved each other what the end would look like if you ever ended, especially if you have children, the smart people would go, look, here's what we're going to agree. In fact, they ought to have a counseling thing when you go to get a marriage license. They ought to have something that says, what are you going to do to protect your kids in the event that you guys, which 60 to 80%, maybe more, actually turn into idiots? What if, and hate each other stupidly? There's no need to hate the person you're divorcing. You know, you just need to end it and recognize it's over and recognize that it's to everybody's benefit if you just attempt to take this person that you loved so much you'd have done anything for. You know, you'll let her see your big fat belly and not worry a thing about it because that it's all true love. Who are we to question true love? We should question the end of true love at the beginning. So you say, look, in the event we do split up, in the event that you decide the neighbor is better looking than me and doesn't have that Dunlap over his belt, then here's how what we're going to do. Let's discuss it now and come up with a contract. You know, it's allowed in many states. It's allowed in Missouri. And you come up with a contract. It's a sort of a prenuptial or even postnuptial. You can do it after you get married. So while you love each other, but then as soon as you do that, you bring that up. Guess what's going to happen? Well, why do we need that? We're never going to split up. It ain't going to happen. What if, I mean, how could you say that? And the men are like, well, geez, what are you worried about going to somebody else? You worried that I will get a girl my Dunlap? Well, anyway, they think about how you get out and what Pakistan is doing here, because a good treaty will have the same thing, how you get out, how you dispute, how you end. And you don't just unilaterally say, I'm not going to follow the treaty that my predecessors made, in this case, in 1960, a water treaty. Okay, so this treaty has been around for 65 years, and now India just says, nah, I don't think so. Pakistan is pointing to the treaty's dispute resolution machinery and recent arbitration decisions that support its aspects of the interpretation of this water treaty. The what they call the it's part of this treaty. The Permanent Court of Arbitration issued another award concerning the treaty earlier this year. So India's position is quite a bit different. India says the relationship underlying the treaty has fundamentally changed, particularly because New Delhi accuses Pakistan of supporting cross-border terrorism in Kashmir. India, therefore, says the treaty can't simply operate as though nothing happened. So our relationship sucks. Therefore, we should renegotiate a water treaty that our predecessors made 65 years ago. 66. I don't know. I'm not sure how I feel about that. We hate each other now, therefore we should do this. And here's the fascinating historical part of this, right? An Indian Ministry of External Affairs document itself describes the treaty as one that could not simply be terminated by one party unless it's replaced by another duly ratified treaty, right? It's, Pakistan appears to be right here. Pakistan has a pretty substantial textual argument in the treaty. India has a substantial national security and political argument. We're not trying to say they're wrong. Those aren't necessarily the same thing, and water is different from a tariff or a punishment. Water is, life. That's why do you think they put this in? So it couldn't be destroyed. Pakistan's agricultural system and food security are connected with the Indus Basin. So now you've gone from, from Kashmir, terrorism and terrorism cross-border into Kashmir by Pakistan, allegedly supported by the government and not these individuals. You have a military confrontation that took place a year ago. You have a suspension of the treaty and water security. This is an escalation ladder, okay? This is India, right? Now you could turn the map a little bit toward China, right? Because India has a dispute with China. And so India and China have an enormous unresolved territorial problem. But instead of moving toward another confrontation, they're doing something very, very unfashionable. It's less than fashionable in the Western world, that's for sure. They're trying to manage this dispute. On August the 6th, India and China held the 36th working, they call it this. This is a great, this is the title of their effort. The 36th Working Mechanism for Consultation and Coordination on India-China Border Affairs in New Delhi. They reviewed the line of actual control because they have soldiers facing each other, in this area. They reviewed this line of actual control. They discussed the boundary delimitation and border management and agreed to continue diplomatic and military mechanisms designed to prevent misunderstandings and miscalculation. And then their border commerce is reopening. On August 1, the India-China border trade through Nathu La resumed after more than 6 years. Trade through Shipki La has also resumed. India and China are demonstrating something very important to the world. Countries do not have to resolve every disagreement before cooperating where their interests overlap. When I was in Kazan 2 years ago at the BRICS conference, before the conference could start, now, number one, that year they did not allow Pakistan to join. And the reason they did is because this did not, is because of this Kashmir dispute, right? And at the same time, before the conference even started, like on the sidelines of it before it started, Modi and Xi Jinping met, and their foreign leaders might even, it was a big deal, that Kazan one in Russia. I was a room away from Vladimir Putin and being allowed in there and first in line to get one of the tickets, and he wouldn't give it to me because I'm an American. I was up there and everybody else is Russian. You know, there's somebody from India, a couple of people from Middle East, and I'm first in line. I'd been waiting there for hours and I knew where they were going to put it. And when I was talking to this professor of, what did she teach? I can't remember. It doesn't matter. She was a university professor there doing some journalism and talking. It was a very interesting conversation and an awesome BRICS thing. Anyway, I'm there to get a ticket. Sorry to give you a story here. And could get a ticket, and the guy's handing them out, and I'm the first in line. I said, give us two tickets. We've been waiting here, you know, for the thing. He goes, and he noticed my accent, you know, because, you know, just like a Russian says something over here in English, when you speak in a Russian over there, they definitely know you're not from there, you have an accent. And so I said, I'm an American. He goes, I'm not going to give a ticket to an American. And he went on. And that was it. I never got in to ask questions. Anyway, that story. But before that thing, before they would all meet in the same room together, Vladimir Putin, Xi Jinping, Narendra Modi, a couple others, the Iranian premier was there, the guy Guterres, who was running the UN at the time. A lot of important people. I think he still runs the UN for that matter. I don't remember. But at any rate, they all had to get together, and India and China, they didn't let Pakistan. They decided that Pakistan had to resolve its dispute with India before they would be allowed in BRICS. And then they said, well, yeah, but what about the dispute between China and India? And they came up with, and this wasn't the first one. They had been working on it for a while. They had one of their working mechanisms for consultation and coordination on the border affairs at that time. And they agreed to continue to work together outside of it, but continue to work integrally on many other fronts. And that is not something the U.S. is the whole West is generally prepared to do. And so that is the craziness of the world, okay? So the border commerce is reopening. You don't have to resolve every single dispute before, you know, you start cooperating. So the Western theory is you have to behave properly in everything, and properly depends on what we, you know, broadcast it as being, and you have behaved improperly in area A, therefore we're going to destroy our cooperation with you in areas B, C, D, and E. And so India and China have increasingly been saying, we disagree profoundly about A, this border dispute, which has been going on for decades. Let's prevent that, though, from exploding while we continue to work together on B, C, and D, like you're planning your divorce before you get married. What approach is more mature? It's harder. It's definitely harder. But that's a legitimate question. And so India is having the 2026 BRICS chair in the official. I'm trying to figure out how to go. Okay, it's next month is when it is, and I haven't received my press pass yet. The official theme is building for resilience, innovation, cooperation, and sustainability. Conveniently, building resilience, innovation, cooperation, and sustainability spells BRICS, which is Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. India describes its approach as people-centric and humanity-first. But let's look underneath the resilience. India says resilience is included in agriculture, health, disaster response, energy, and supply chains. This one is enormous. Why? because sanctions taught Russia, taught China, Iran, taught India, you know, all of these things that the West just controls. They don't like this. And the financial restrictions that the West can control taught much of the global South that dependence is vulnerability. So resilience in BRICS language means building a world in which one government cannot just turn off another government's economic oxygen and destroy it. You can't do that. And innovation. India explicitly lists digital public infrastructure, emerging technologies, fintech, financial tech, AI, and knowledge sharing. And BRICS cooperation isn't theoretical in that anymore either. 11 BRICS countries participated in the BRICS Heads of Space Agency meeting in Bengaluru this summer. Brazil, China, Egypt, Ethiopia, India, Indonesia, Iran, Russia, Saudi Arabia, South Africa, and the UAE. Think about that. Does that look like Russia is or Iran are isolated? Does Iran, you know, who's isolated? Are we the ones that are isolated? Isolated from the world? I don't know. Maybe we should go to the funny farm, you know, where life is beautiful all the time. And I'll be happy to see those nice young men in their clean white coats coming to take me away. Ha ha, he he, ho ho. So, cooperation. India says BRICS cooperation needs to include development, finance, trade facilitation, policy coordination, and reform of... this is big. And this is what they've been bitching about for at least 20 years. Reform of global institutional governance. And then we get to one of my favorite world diplomats, Jaishankar. And I don't care what his internal policies are, but that man is well-spoken. It makes sense. He's afraid of nothing. He will go out and say to an enemy sitting right next to him, you know, let's work together and do this, and don't conflate issues. Don't target my country. Let's address the issue. What difference does it make? Because you can't talk to Russia ever. Our diplomats suck, okay? Our diplomats in the West are idiots. Why? Because they take this huge, huge generalist approach and say, we're pissed off at you on A, therefore B, C, D, and E, you're done there too. I don't take things that way. You know, if I say something anti you, it's not because I hate you. I don't give a crap. I don't care. I address issues, and these issues, I think, in general, need to be resolved, right? And you resolve the issue, and then you keep your relationship on that level. It's extremely hard to do, and people cannot do it. Therefore, they just cancel people. We cancel countries. That's what we do. And we cancel everything about that country, because once they've done one little thing or one big thing or something that we can't agree with, well, screw you then. We control the world. We're going to shut the world off to you, China. You went into Venezuela. What are we going to do? We're going to go in, capture their leader, throw him in prison, charge him with having a firearm. Using a firearm in furtherance of terrorism, and in the U.S. court, and I don't trust the court to make the right decision, but the right decision ought to be to throw that case out and let the guy go back to Venezuela, or retire him to an island in the Caribbean somewhere else. You know, but let him go. This is nonsense, in my humble view. But Jaishankar is one of my favorites. He talked about reformed multilateralism. Here we are on this topic again. And he specifically identified four organizations. The United Nations, which is extremely U.S. dominated and lopsided and nobody follows. The World Trade Organization, same thing.
International Monetary Fund dictates what you have to do inside your country socially in order to receive a loan, and the World Bank the exact same thing. These institutions need to become more representative of the world and inclusive, and that's much stronger than BRICS wants its own currency. If they did this, you wouldn't get a talk about a different currency. They wouldn't create their own payment mechanisms to go through the Russian, not Swift Bank, like I have a Mir card, you know, you pay for your stuff through a totally different system. And China has joined it and created their own. India has joined both of those and receives payment from those. People can make Mir card payments in some of those countries. I could use my Russian card. And I don't know, this isn't about, it's a bigger story. And there's a brand new BRICS thing that happened this morning. And the official BRICS India site lists a 12th BRICS Environment Ministers meeting as its later major event. And there's already a significant dispute coming out of it. BRICS countries have objected to the European Union's carbon border adjustment mechanism, which characterizes such unilateral carbon border measures as discriminatory and protectionist trade barriers. So, you know, Europe says climate policy and BRICS says protectionism dressed up as climate policy. Who's right? Maybe both have grains of the truth, but notice once again that the name you give a policy determines how the public perceives it. Carbon adjustment, sanction, tariff, security measure, or peace initiative, special operation, humanitarian intervention, rules-based order. Everybody has a vocabulary, and vocabulary can be very powerful. So, America has become exceptionally good at confusing its preferred description of reality with reality. You know, America has periodically portrayed BRICS as something threatening, or something anti-American. But when India assumed the presidency, they also assumed that Trump, well, we know Trump had previously threatened an additional 10% tariff against any country that aligns themselves with what he called BRICS anti-American policies. There is no anti-American policy in BRICS. If you look at India's BRICS official program head, they're talking about AI, agriculture, health, supply chains, climate, development finance, institutional reform, technology, trade, space cooperation. You can disagree with all of it, none of it, any of it, doesn't matter. But what exactly is the anti-American part in there? No idea. There isn't any. So you could say BRICS contains governments allowed in there with profoundly conflicting interests. India and China have a territorial dispute. India and China and Pakistan have antagonistic relationships. China and India compete economically. Saudi Arabia and Iran have competing regional interests. Russia and India don't agree about everything either. Therefore, BRICS may be better at issuing declarations than exercising any sort of unified geopolitical power. That's a, you know, pretty serious criticism, because they didn't. Iran was pissed off because BRICS wouldn't come up with an anti-U.S. statement back when this initially started. So, but perhaps BRICS' weakness, if you want to call it that, is actually the source of why it's going to be sticking around. It's because it doesn't require India to become China. It doesn't require Saudi Arabia to become Iran. It doesn't require Brazil to adopt Russian foreign policy. It requires cooperation where their interests coincide. And that's fundamentally different from any other alliance that's out there. And that's exactly why, in my humble view, that organization is going to continue expanding. And so, you know, we've got this beautiful Napoleon, the 14th sign, that I, song that I'd like to share with you from 1966, which I already did, but there's one that came up another one that goes, "We will all go together when we go." That's by a guy named Tom Lehrer. It's from 1959. And I want to play that one for you. It was kind of a Cold War nuclear satire theme. But let's play that and see where we go, because that could be fun. A little slow in starting.
I always like to end on a positive note, so here is a rousing, uplifting song which is guaranteed to cheer you up. When you attend a funeral, it is sad to think that sooner or later those you love will do the same for you. And you may have thought it tragic, not to mention other adjectives, to think of all the weeping they will do. But don't you worry, no more ashes, no more sackcloth, and an armband made of black cloth will someday nevermore adorn a sleeve. For if the bomb that drops on you gets your friends and neighbors too, there'll be nobody left behind to grieve, and we will all go together when we go. What a comforting fact that is to know. Universal bereavement, an inspiring achievement. Yes, we all will go together when we go. We will all go together when we go, all suffused with an incandescent glow. No one will have the endurance to collect on his insurance. Lloyd's of London will be loaded when they go. We will all fry together when we fry. We'll be French fried potatoes by and by. There will be no more misery when the world is our rotisserie. Yes, we all will fry together when we fry. We will all bake together when we bake. There'll be nobody present at the wake. With complete participation in that grand incineration, nearly 3 billion hunks of well-done steak. We will all char together when we char. And let there be no moaning of the bar. Just sing out a te deum when you see that ICBM, and the party will be come as you are. We will all burn together when we burn. There'll be no need to stand and wait your turn. When it's time for the fallout and St. Peter calls us all out, we'll just drop our agendas and adjourn. We will all go together when we go. Every Hottentot and every Eskimo. When the air becomes Uranus, we will all go simultaneous. Yes, we all will go together when we all go together. Yes, we all will go together when we go.
All go together when we go, if we continue on these idiotic policies that we have. So I thought I'd refresh that. That was from 1959. And that was a guy named Tom Lehrer. And, you know, kind of dark, but very cheerful. Cold War nuclear satire. Basically, don't worry about your nuclear annihilation. At least nobody will have to mourn anybody else. So there's a couple other ones that I thought about sharing, but we'll get to those another time that maybe we'll put out there and say something like, you know what? I may play them anyway. But I wanted to talk about, I don't know. Let's talk about this. Maybe the insanity of the world and the funny farm where their life is beautiful and they're all coming to take us away. Maybe the insanity isn't that India can cooperate with Russia, even though it has disputes, can compete with China, and can still work with them on various topics. They can negotiate with Washington. They can confront Pakistan simultaneously. Maybe that's what Jai Shankar and his wonderful foreign policy takes and the policy that they pursue in India is for his country so nationalist and so great that it's I believe he's a foreign minister that needs to be taken extremely seriously. So the strange part about our foreign policy is that every country on earth has to choose a side. Choose a side. Are you with the U.S. and the destruction? Are you with China and those other a-holes? You know? So welcome to the funny farm where life is beautiful all the time. You know, I wanted to get to... This has been going on for a while, by the way. Governments aren't new at this. Let's talk about this because I have something else a little more timely to share with you on the music theme. Napoleon the 14th gave us the world has gone crazy and they're coming to take us away. I want to talk about the Kinks. And so the world isn't necessarily what you thought it was, is it? I don't know. Do you ever remember the song Lola, which I'm going to play for you? Ray Davies wrote Lola for the Kinks, and it was released in June 1970. And as a narrative, it's pretty straightforward. An inexperienced young man goes to a club in Soho, meets Lola, is attracted to her, but gradually, as the evening progresses, he realizes that the assumptions he made when he walked into the club might have been wrong. The gender ambiguity in the song is absolutely intentional. Davies described doing research among drag queens, and he said that he admired people willing to be what and who they wanted to be. Interestingly, he's also resisted reducing Lola to a simple label, saying the character was based on a real person and that the underlying story was ultimately about friendship and the fact that things aren't always what they seem to be. And so, you know, I don't care about transgender politics. I give a rip. You know, if you wish to dress up like a clown every day, you know, and you have a clown fetish, great. You want to dress up like a woman. I don't care. You want to dress up like a man if you're a woman. I don't care about that either. You want to live together as man and man or woman and woman. I give a rip. God love you for it. The world's a beautiful place for all sorts of people. And I try hard not to judge, right? I don't need to make this about transgender politics. I'm not sure I'd want to have you as an overnight guest, but I don't think I'd kick you necessarily out of my house because, you know, I'd be pretty upfront. Let's say I had a young child in my house and someone walked in that was a transgender. I'd, you know, and the kid, because kids think like kids. You know, why is that man dressed up like a woman? Well, because that's his right. And he can, you know, I would maybe use it as a coaching scenario. I wouldn't judge them. I don't know. I'm not necessarily sure that I would want them 24/7 in front of my school children. I don't know about that, you know, but as long as I had the freedom to take that kid to another school, I'm not sure I don't want it in public schools, really. And if it is in public schools, boy, then the funding to leave that public school ought to be there. And I'm spitballing that. I haven't sat down and thought about it. But the world isn't always what you think it is. And so, you know, in the Lola song, especially, you know, it's not very long. It's remember, and I say this all the time. The line I always remember is what? It's a mixed up, muddled up, shook up world. Except for Lola, of course. And there's a great censorship story. This is the BBC and Britain, at the time this song came out, trying to control the narrative. You couldn't have a song like this. A song about this? You couldn't. They object to Coca-Cola also. So the BBC didn't necessarily object to the gender content. They objected to Coca-Cola. The original recording in the United States named Coca-Cola. Tastes just like Coca-Cola. C-O-L-A, Cola. Remember that? Sorry to sing to you. That's horrific. But it was Coca-Cola. The BBC rules, though, prohibited what it regarded as commercial and product references, so Davies had to change it in the British version to Cherry Cola. He was touring America at the time the song was released, and he actually had to fly back across the Atlantic to London to re-record the offensive word Coca-Cola so the record could be received at BBC and get airplay. Otherwise, it wasn't going to get anything. 1970s Britain, gender ambiguity, song about that? We'll let that go, but don't mention Coca-Cola. We got to stop the press. Maybe the funny farm was going on long before. Davies later made another observation. He said that people often hear only a fraction of a song's lyrics before deciding that they like it. They latch on to the catchy portion rather than really examining what they are hearing. That's exactly the information problem we're talking about. He brought it up in 1970. He goes, people never listen. They just take the catchy part and repeat it. That's it. That's exactly the information problem that we're living with today. It was the same in 1970, and he had to fly over and not talk about Coca-Cola, had to talk about Cherry Cola. So they don't examine a complete proposition. That happens all the time. They examine a headline, and that's it. They hear a slogan. They recognize the political term or team, and they say, I'm on that team, and they decide whether they agree. Only afterward is it possible that they might process the underlying facts. And Lola is enormous. This wasn't just some counterculture recording. It reached number two in Britain, spent 7 weeks in the UK top 10, and 14 weeks on the charts. It reached number nine in the United States and number one in several other countries. So more importantly, it saved the Kinks commercially, and they badly needed a hit. They had years in which the ability to tour America had been disrupted. Davies later said that if Lola hadn't succeeded, the band might have continued making records for another year and then drifted apart. So the song about uncertainty saved the band, the Kinks. And, I'm thinking the Funny Farm goes just perfectly with the mixed up, muddled up, shook up world. And so I'm going to play that for you because it is a mixed up, muddled up, shook up world, except for Lola.
I met her in a club down in Old Soho where you drink champagne and it tastes like Coca-Cola. C-O-L-A Cola. She walked up to me and she asked me to dance. I asked her her name and in a dark brown voice she said Lola. L-O-L-A Lola. La 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 Lola. Well, I'm not the world's most physical guy, but when she squeezed me tight she nearly broke my spine. La 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 la.
Well, there you go. That's the destruction we're talking about. There's some more songs about destruction that come up that I thought would be funny to add on. And this one, I came out the year... Well, we won't talk about that. That's we'll talk about this come up. It's this one's a little more. I don't know what you would call it. This is kind of a history sort of thing, right? And we're gonna bring it up just because I kind of like the structure. And I think after the coming to take me away, after we'll all go together, the bombing. Now we're gonna get to a little bit more. We're going to blow ourselves up anyway, but we're going to be happy when we do it. So we're going to, this guy doesn't go to the funny farm. He realizes the same thing that Mr. Lehrer recognized. This guy's Barry McGuire, called The Eve of Destruction, and we're going to play that for you.
Eastern world, it is exploding, violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating. But you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't. Don't you understand what I'm trying to say? Can't you feel the fears I'm feeling today? If the button is pushed, there's no running away. There'll be no one to save with the world in a grave. Take a look around you, boy. It's bound to scare you, boy. And you tell me my blood's so mad, feels like coagulating. I'm sitting here just contemplating. I can't twist the truth, it knows no regulation. Handful of senators don't pass legislation, and marches alone can't bring integration. When human respect is disintegrating, this whole crazy world is just too frustrating. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Think of all the hate there is in Red China, then take a look around to Selma, Alabama. You may leave here for 4 days in space, but when you return, it's the same old place. The pounding of the drums, the pride and disgrace. You can bury your dead, but don't leave a trace. Hate your next door neighbor, but don't forget to say grace and tell me.
The Eve of Destruction. Isn't that terrible? That, tell you what, that's a nice 1960s song to come out and war-related and everything like that. Kind of a protest song. And the video of it was kind of cool. Obviously made years later, but it has all the
you know, video and footage from that time period. It's kind of cool to watch it. You go out and find it on YouTube if you like. So we've listened to Tom Lehrer. We've listened to They're Coming to Take Me Away by Napoleon the 14th, who's certainly funny. We're going to play that again before the end just because I like it. But I wanted to go back to, now damn it, I've moved my cursor. The world according to labels. Let's put labels out there because that's what's important. You know, we're in America, you got to label everything and you got to hate this or hate that, you know, being for this. And if you're for this, that means you've got to be against that. And you're not allowed to have a different set of opinions just because you're part of a different group. You're allowed to have individual thought processes and things you like versus things you don't like. But America, you know, a lot of us, they tell us the following. India is an American strategic partner. That's advertising, right? It's true, but it's also advertising. India is chairing BRICS. That's also true. India participates in the Quad with the United States. True. India maintains an extraordinarily important relationship with Russia. True. India has a major territorial dispute with China. True. India is simultaneously reopening border commerce with China in many of their borders. And they have a long border. And that's also true. India has a profound security disagreement with Pakistan. True. And yet, India and Pakistan are both members of some of the same international organizations. True. So if your political worldview requires that every country fit into a good guy, bad guy sort of scenario, wouldn't all of that stuff from India would make your head explode? How are you gonna take all of these things in this mixed up, muddled up, shook up world, except for Lola, and justify it, rectify this enormous problem that India compartmentalizes? Compartmentalization is actually something that people need to learn more of, in my humble view. Let's go quickly to Pakistan, okay? Because categories aren't the muddled up part. You know, our categories aren't the muddled up, you know, part of the shook up, muddled up, mixed up world, except for Lola, of course. But we're going to go to Pakistan. They've got fresh Indus Waters treaty story that we just talked about. But now think about it differently. India says terrorism has fundamentally changed the relationship and that treaty obligation doesn't exist anymore. But Pakistan says, wait a minute, India, you can't just suspend your treaty obligation. Pakistan says water is a red line. India says national security is a red line. Both governments have created a narrative, right? Well, why don't we read the treaty? And what does the treaty say? That's the international flavor method of dealing with things. That's the way when your prenuptial agreement comes up. Remember Jim Carrey? Anyway, that was funny. The international flavors approach is read the whole treaty. Read the document. Check the law. Don't tell me who's wearing a white hat, who's right and who's wrong. Maybe you don't like Pakistanis. Oh, gee, that means Indians right. Maybe Pakistan pissed you off last week. Well, that's, you know, unfortunate, but that's the read the document. Follow the treaty that your ancestors or your predecessors wrote, signed, put into place, and left there, hopefully forever. Without an exit strategy, there's probably an exit into it that says, here's what happened in the event of disagreements. Use the treaty. Use the arbitration process that's already reflecting that Pakistan is getting some action, some at least resolution of some of the issues through this treaty and arbitration panel.
So let's talk about China. What do we talk about when we get to China? Let's go to the same exercise. We're repeatedly told India and China are rivals. Correct. They're the two biggest countries in the world. And that swapped about however many years ago, but China used to be, population-wise. India's about 400 million. Is it 400 million? 1.48 billion. And China's like 1.4 billion. So whatever that happens to be. I think it's 800 million. But what the hell? I'm not looking at the numbers on the screen, so I can't tell you. But they, you expect their relationship would collapse if they're such rivals, except they're talking to each other. They're managing the line of actual control. They're doing it. They're reopening their border trade. They're competitors, and yet they're adversaries and also economic partners. That's not inconsistent. That's part of international relations. And this is where Washington has increasingly, over the years, gotten itself into trouble. We watch this, everything that we've watched since I was in the diplomatic corps and had a diplomatic passport back in the 90s, right? And I wasn't anything major. I was just an interpreter, a young interpreter with a diplomatic passport. It was a cool period of time for me. And I thought the world was going to be a better place. Not a mixed up, muddled up, shook up world, except for Lola. Washington, we've increasingly seen across the West since my entire lifetime, we've treated diplomacy as a moral, a religious, and it's not religious, but it's certainly morality, you know, where it's moral. Talking to Putin means you approve of Putin. Oh, my God, you can't do that. What if you talk to that guy in Iran? I forget his name right now, so I'm sorry about that. And if you speak to him, are you suddenly in trouble? I think you are. So Washington's gotten it into increasingly difficult waters as diplomacy because we don't have any diplomats. They all suck. All they got is moral endorsement. You know, well, geez, if you believe in us, you believe in democracy. Really? Is that what we're after? If you work with us, Israel will be prevailing over Iran, and Iran will never get a nuclear bomb. Iran at some point is going to get a nuclear bomb if they want one. North Korea got one. Trump doesn't have any problem with that. We're supposed to hate them, right? Talking to Putin means you approve of Putin. That's no good. And you got to beat up on Trump for months over that. Any trade with China, holy crap, you approve of China. What's wrong with you? China's fighting with India, and India's our trading partner, our strategic partner. Buying Russian oil means that you support Russia. Really? Doesn't it just mean I need oil and they sell it the cheapest, and I have to sanction these guys because you don't like them? That's what the rest of the world is seeing. And joining BRICS means you oppose America. That's the narrative. But India is saying increasingly no. Jai Shankar says it straight out, bluntly. We'll talk to anybody we want to. We'll trade where it benefits us. You can't provide oil and natural gas to us, and if you could, it'd be triple the price of what we can get from Russia through China or any other means we choose. We'll disagree with you where our interests diverge, but where they converge, we'll work together with you regardless of where you're from. And what disputes we have. We'll set those disputes aside and work for them. And we'll decide what is good for India. Now, am I sitting here telling you India would be a fantastic country? No, never been there yet. Trying to get there. Insist on going there. But going there and seeing one point of India isn't going to give a whole lot of perspective. It's a huge country. And if all I do is go to New Delhi and don't get out to any of the other beautiful places, my perception is going to be limited, right? I've been in many, 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 many places inside of Russia. I really loved walking around the downtown squares in Ufa. And Ufa was about an hour from Yangon Tao, the place where I went to the sanitarium. It was friggin' beautiful, the whole place. But that's not Vladikavkaz. Vladikavkaz was beautiful in its own way. Moscow, this way. I love Moscow and the metro stations and going around in there. I'm going to go this year to St. Petersburg. Never been there. And I'm going at Christmas time on purpose because I want a different perspective. A dream I would have would be to take the Orient Express and take that sucker across the, you know, the entire stretches of land across there. See what I can do. I'm researching it, seeing what I can do. But the world's a funny farm. You know, well, India, however, is managing their funny farm, at least their view of it, in a pretty coherent way. They will disagree with you where their interests are not in line with what they decide. And they personally are going to decide what's good for India. And that's a more traditional concept of foreign policy. And why is it that when you hear Jai Shankar, you hear Narendra Modi, you hear Xi Jinping, and you really listen to him, and you listen to Vladimir Putin, Sergei Lavrov, and what I call world-class politicians, and more importantly, world-class diplomats, that all the ones from this side of the world, and I shouldn't say all, there's some shining examples of some good people, but as a whole, our system revolves around, I don't want to call it propaganda, but certainly narratives. It revolves around the narrative. Work with Russia on something, on a financial project? No, you can't do that. Russia's the bad guy. Try to work with India to develop something? Oh, no, you can't do that. That's a Muslim country. They slice women in half, somebody told me one time. They take their women and cut them in half. Oh, really? Is that what they're doing? You know, we have horror stories in America as well. It doesn't mean that's what we do, okay? Is there extremism? Unfortunately, yep, it's everywhere. But it's not limited to Iran, you know? And they want to protect themselves without having to bow down and lick the rear ends of the rest of the world, just like any country would like to. And they may be large enough to hold out. You know, 102 million or something like that was one of the numbers I saw of how many they have people, or was it 90 something? I don't know. I think at one point it was in the 100 million, and 100 million people that don't get to choose how they wish to live, and interact with the rest of the world. More importantly, because that's only dictated by a unilateral group. Of course they're trying to get out of that. And I'm not trying to justify Iran or anything like that. My opinions on that are generally pretty clear. So what we're going to do is remember that the funny farm does exist. And India has a, in my view, a more traditional concept of foreign policy than what we have. And so... You can't just say America lies about everything, the West lies about everything, and everybody else is therefore telling the truth. That's not true. You know, that's a weak statement. But you absolutely can say that we are, as a culture, as an American group, we are somewhat insulated from recognizing a government narrative when it comes out, because the entire government and media structure supports the narrative of two different bands or camps of people. And so you listen to one camp and you're going to get this narrative. You listen to the other camp and we're going to get that narrative. And so every 4 years, that comes out huge because of an election and how who gets to control that narrative. And that's the important thing, is the controlling of the narrative to control the population so that when the vote occurs, it'll go the way of whoever you wish to, you know, whoever wants the most. And so there's protests that come up on that. And so I'm going to share one more song with you about protests, and I've done it before, but I love this one too, and I just love a good protest song, and this is a good one, and one of my favorites. So here we go. Let us protest, shall we? I'm going to.
Well, now, ladies and gentlemen, it's talent spotting time. And please put your hands together for a very big warm welcome, please, to Raymond Scum.
This next song is a protest song. Ladies and gentlemen, I've suffered for my music. Now it's your turn. Prophets of doom can always find room in a world full of worry and fear. Tip cigarettes and chemistry sets and Rudolph the red-nosed reindeer. So I'm going back to my little old shack and drink me a bottle of wine. That was mise en bouteille before my birthday, and have me fucking good time. Rain on a tin roof sounds like a drum. We're marching for freedom today. Hey, turn on your headlights and sound your horn if people get in the way. The chromium swan on the nose of a long limousine. Even hide for the day, it has something to say, but what the hell does it mean? I may be accused of being confused, but I'm average weight for my height. My philosophy, like color TV, is all there in black and white. Rain, rain on a tin roof sounds like a drum. We're marching for freedom today. Yeah, turn on your headlights and sound your horn if people get in the way.
Protest song. We are protesting. And we're protesting people that do not compartmentalize when it comes to their diplomacy. I prefer compartmentalization. It got me thinking, though, of these wonderful protest songs and the people singing. And, you know, Bob Dylan is 85 years old right now. And if you go out to YouTube, you can see some of his earliest things of where he was playing. And one of the ones that I like watching, I'm going to share it with you at the end of this show here, which is coming up upon us. And I'm going to share it just because you look at this kid and he is so young when he's out here. This is, he was born in 1941. So he's really, he looks like he's about 10, but this was in 1963. And somebody posted this out there. It's got millions of views. So in 1963, he'd have been 22 years old. And it's unbelievable to think that there he is. And this one's kind of a, this is a real protest song from 1963. And what's the name of it? It's North County Blues from the Newport Folk Festival in 1963. See, here's a 22-year-old, and he just freaking controlled the place. And if you like protest songs, you know, here's a decent protest song, okay?
This is a song about iron ore mines and iron ore town. Come and gather round, friends, and I'll tell you a tale of where the red iron ore pits run aplenty. But the cardboard filled windows and old men on the benches tell you now that the whole town is empty. In the north, in the town, my own children have grown. But I was raised on the other. In the wee hours of youth, my mother took sick. And I was brought up by my brother. Oh, the iron ore poured as the years passed the door. They dragged lines and shovels, they was a-humming. Till one day my brother failed to come home, the same as my father before him. With a long winter's wait from the window I watched. My friends, they couldn't have been kinder. And my schooling was cut as I quit in the spring to marry John Thomas, a miner. The years passed again and the giving was good, with a lunch bucket filled every season. But with three babies born, the work was cut down to a half a day shift with no reason. Then the shaft was soon shut and more work was cut, and the fire in the outlet fell frozen. Till a man come to speak, and he said in 1 week that number 11 was closing. They say in the east they are paying too high. They say that your ore ain't worth digging, that it's much cheaper down in the South American towns, where the miners work almost for nothing. So the mining gates locked and the red iron rotted, and the room smelled heavy from drinking. And the sad silent song made the hour twice as long as I waited for the sun to go sinking. I lived by the window as he talked to himself. This silence of tongues it was building, till one morning's week they bet it was bad, and I was left alone with three children. This summer is gone, the ground's turning cold. The stars one by one are folding. My children will go listen as they grow. For there ain't nothing here now but to hold them.
How's that for a protest song? So that was a protest song from Bob Dylan in 1963. Good stuff, huh? And now we have me talking about coming to take you away. Ha ha, he he, ho ho. You know, we in America, we recognize Russian propaganda. As soon as we hear, oh, geez, that's Vladimir Putin's Russian propaganda. We recognize Chinese propaganda. It's everywhere. TikTok's going to take us over. We recognize Iranian propaganda. For sure, they're everywhere. But when our own government selects information, changes terminology, omits inconvenient context, or constructs a politically useful description, what we call it is the news. That's what we do. And it's a, I don't know, it's a proposition. It'll, you know, we can be skeptical of everyone rather than simply just change which government's propaganda you believe. Has the world gone insane? Or is, you know, Bob Dylan singing about that type of thing in 1963, an iron ore being picked up in South America rather than anywhere where his country is, in this this song where the children are all leaving these minor towns because there's nothing left to hold them. The misperception of reality is dangerous when governments possess nuclear weapons and people act on perceptions. Pakistan has nuclear weapons. India has nuclear weapons. China has nuclear weapons. Russia has nuclear weapons. And America has nuclear weapons. So understanding what the other side actually thinks than what we'd prefer to believe it thinks isn't an intellectual exercise. It's a skill of survival. They're coming to take us away. Ha ha, he he, ho ho.
Be happy to see those nice young men in their clean white coats, and they're coming to take me away.
To the happy home with trees and flowers and chirping birds and basket weavers who sit and